What I'd like to do briefly is to look at what we might have done had we had the time in terms of a more thorough examination of individual episodes in that narrative. We did summarize the various emphases with regard to how God makes a difference in the Joseph narrative in the various areas, and you recall we discussed the advancement and deliverance crises, including dream crises, the brother crises, morality crisis, etc. Let me very quickly look with you at one of those crises involving what happens in Potiphar's house at the beginning of chapter 39. And we'll look at it in light of a principle of interpretation which I want you to become acquainted with and which we'll be using further in the course and which you ought to use in your interpretation later on. And that has to do with the technique of putting oneself in the place of biblical characters. Which really involves the principle of empathy. Empathos, pathos, to feel in the place of someone. So it's the empathic principle of interpretation. And it has value in two ways. First of all, it helps us to recreate or to relive the experience of biblical characters, which is the essence of interpretation. That is especially true when you're dealing with biographical materials or historical materials, the latter, of course, involving people acting, even though the focus may not be on the people. The essence of interpretation is recreation, and this fosters the process of recreation. And secondly, it introduces a note of realism into biblical interpretation which is often missing. It helps you to focus on the human dimension of these men and women of faith. Now, with regard to the second of these, I get the feeling very often that we don't really deal with biblical characters as human beings. We deal with them as sort of quasi-human beings whose theology overrides their humanity. So they move blithely along in life, you know, nothing really bothers them. They have a constant smile on their faces, you know, as if they have a hanger in their mouths. Because after all, they have faith. Nothing supposed to bother you when you have faith. See? These are real human beings. Like you and me. And one of the problems we have when we try to relate our experiences to the experiences of biblical characters is that because we view biblical characters unrealistically, somehow we misjudge ourselves and say, well, how come these biblical characters got along so beautifully? How come I have struggled? There's something wrong with me. Now, something may be wrong with us. I'm not saying nothing can be wrong with us. But I think we fail to recognize the true humanity of these biblical characters. One of the reasons for that is the terseness of the accounts. The accounts are very brief. They don't get involved in human emotions, thoughts, attitudes, very often. Sometimes they do, but not very often. They're just told a very, very terse story. And what you need to do is to read between the lines, carefully to be sure, to try to recreate what happens in the lives of these people in order that we may have a more realistic view of them and in order that we may relate them more accurately to our own experience. And so it's for that reason that I suggested that you do something of this sort, and this indicates the format that I didn't suggest to you, various ways of doing it, which involves describing the human historical situation apart from God. Just treat this person as a human being. How does this person feel? What thoughts are going through this person's mind? What attitudes are involved here? What are the fears, etc., of this person? And then look at the acts and being of God, both affirmed explicitly, but also assumed or implied. This gets us at implications. This is another reason why I want to do it with you, even though we have to do it quickly. In other words, this introduces now the theological dimension. This is the human historical dimension. This is the theological dimension. And then the difference that God makes. We've already indicated these differences that God makes. And very often we don't think in terms of what might have happened had not God been involved. That's really what the story is telling us, that something unusual happened, different from what might have happened, had not God been involved. Now, with this in mind, let me very quickly look with you at that episode at the opening of 39, and I urge you to turn your Bibles to that material. You don't have a lot of time to refer to it very specifically. But it's the story of Joseph in Potiphar's house. We're told in 37 that he's 17 years old when the episodes of 37 happen, so he is a very young lad when he reaches Potiphar's house. This high officer in Egypt and in the armed forces of Egypt. So let's put ourselves now into the shoes of this young man in this situation. Having been sold by his brothers out of hatred and jealousy, having had a certain relationship with his family, particularly his father, having had these high expectations, these dreams he had, you know, all of a sudden these dreams seem to be smashed. There he is in Potiphar's house, a slave. Now here are the kinds of things. We look at them very, very quickly. We don't have the time to comment on them, but I think they're rather self-explanatory. Fear of the unknown, what's going to happen to me. Culture shock in a totally different society, where, as we discovered, the Hebrews were looked on with disdain. So far from being a favored one, as he was in his father's house, and having a special position in Canaan, he's now in a culture in which he's looked down on with disdain. Bitter disappointment and discouragement. Loneliness, homesickness, wrenched out of this situation. Possible doubt regarding God's presence and faithfulness. Now, we're dealing only here only with potential, maybe potential feelings. We don't have to say we know he felt this way. We're trying to recreate possibilities, potentialities. Some of these were undoubtedly here, if he was human at all. By the way, I remember my one episode of homesickness. I went to a camp when I was 12 years old, and I have never had such a strong emotion as I had at that camp in terms of wanting to get back home. I didn't care how I did it. I had to go out on the street and hitchhike, which I was not accustomed to doing. I would do it. I wanted to get home, period. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling, but it's one of the strongest emotions I've ever felt. The resentment toward his brothers, that you can be pretty sure was there, particularly in light of the subsequent evidence. And perhaps he had vengeful feelings, possible rebellion against Potiphar. You know, here he was, this overseer, and he could have had quite mixed feelings toward him. Do I submit myself to this man? What's he going to tell me to do? By the way, am I going to spend my rest of my life here as a slave? You know the history of slaves. It's not a very good history, is it? So these are the kinds of things I had in mind that emerge when you try to recreate a human situation. And in effect, you're saying, now, what is it, quite apart from the influence of God? Or what might it be, quite apart from the influence of God? And as I say, some of these feelings we can be pretty sure he had. Others are possibilities, but we don't need to be dogmatic at this point. We just need to try to see these people as human beings, like you and me. And the reason why we can see them as human beings is because we have a common lived experience, shared lived experience. Now, as to the theology, there's much more here than meets the eye. You know, you have statements like the Lord was with Joseph. which is emphasized several times in those materials as you see them before you. There's an awful lot implied in that kind of thing. The active personal presence of God in this new situation, and as I say, always in biblical materials, nearness means activity. Not merely a place, matter of place, it's a matter of action. But that in itself involves a whole theology. The constancy of God, even in the midst of this change, dramatically different situation. And yet the same God who was active in his life previously, when he was with his family in Canaan, is now active here. Involves in turn the faithfulness of God, the loving concern of God. Nothing has changed as far as God is concerned. Circumstances do not change God. That's the meaning of these narratives. Circumstances do not change God. They may change our feelings and our experiences, but they don't change God. The beauty, for example, of that experience in prison. Bars don't keep God out of prison. They may keep human beings out, human beings in, but not God. The universality of God. He is active now in Egypt as well as in Canaan. Here's another episode, and you've seen several of them already, in which this God is not a tribal God tied to a certain land only, but rather is able to act in other areas of the world because, of course, he is the creator of the entire universe. So there's no limitation upon his action, etc. We could go into that more fully. Here again, we won't allude to the text just to save time, but I've got the references down. He influences the success and failure of individuals. By the way, that applies not only to Joseph, but to Potiphar as well. Everything that Potiphar had was blessed because of Joseph. His actions are revelatory even to an unbeliever. You need to move rapidly here, so just keep this in mind. He influences the attitude of unbelievers, or the unbeliever toward his own. This, of course, is what happens in relation to Pharaoh as well. So he's not limited to influencing only those who have faith. Brings prosperity to the unbeliever for the sake of his own people. God's blessing includes the non-human world as well as humans. Everything that Potiphar had was blessed, including his possessions, etc. Go on here. But you see the tremendous theology that you have here. A theology of providence is how we describe it. And the providence that you have at work here has to do not only with how God acts toward an individual of faith, but how God acts also in a society, with individuals as well, but in a society made up, at least primarily, of unbelievers. Now, if God could not act in that kind of society, he could not keep his promises, keep his covenant. His covenant would have been broken had he not been able to influence people like Potiphar and Pharaoh. So God is providentially at work even in the midst of evil. This relates also to the brothers, in order to keep his covenant and to effect his purposes. So, we found in the Abraham narrative, by way of resolving the problem that we noticed in 1 to 11, particularly in chapter 3, we have the God who makes and begins to keep the covenant and continues to keep it, not only throughout this book, by the way, but throughout many books, many years, many generations. That's the Abraham narrative. The Jacob narrative, the God who transforms human beings, and he's got to do that to keep the covenant. And in the Joseph narrative, the God who acts providentially in history is able to affect human situations, even in evil societies, in order to be able to keep his promises and his covenant and to redeem his people and through them the people of the whole world. So that, in a nutshell, is a theology of 12 to 50 which accounts for the process by which God, who created this universe, which has gone awry, returns, in effect, to redeem it through a covenant.
Do you have any brief comment on the nature of Joseph's wife compared to, say, Isaac, who had to find a special wife, Abram, and here he is marrying somebody from the Egyptian line, but still the children promised him?
Oh, yes, yes. The interesting thing about the covenant and how it's kept in the Old Testament is that non-Hebrews enter the covenant line, sometimes by marriage, sometimes in other ways. You have, for example, Ruth, the book of Ruth. You have Rahab the harlot in the conquest of Canaan, etc. So, yes, and the genealogies, by the way, of the Gospels reflect that. There's nothing wrong with bringing in Gentiles. The question is not Jews or Gentiles, but which Gentiles and how do they relate to the covenant people. And there's no indication that you have a problem here that you had, for example, with Esau and the Canaanite wives. Or the problem that you have later on, for example, with Solomon, when Solomon is influenced by his wives to worship idols. You don't have that kind of thing. So that faithfulness to the God of the covenant is not apparently an issue here. And because that's not an issue, it doesn't make any difference really whether they're Hebrew or non-Hebrew wives.
It's almost like the pots or rods that were ring straight and all these other things. Case that no matter what Jacob did, his flocks, he brought them, and God blessed that?
I don't know. There's no indication here. There is an indication there about how the episode is interpreted, but there's no indication here that Joseph was doing what was right or wasn't right in the sight of God, certainly not the latter. I have to say I don't know, but it's quite possible that this could have happened with God's approval. As I say, there's no indication in the Old Testament that Hebrews had to be exclusive with regard to marrying Hebrews until later on. Now, the exclusivism came into the picture later on, when you get particularly in the post-Jewish period, where God insists that they marry only Hebrews.
I'm finding a bit of
a
tension about the concept of God that I'm starting to see, that he could just be seen as a manipulative, kind of moving everybody around as he sees fit and playing kind of with it as far as the picture I'm getting. Is that something you might address like in an extra session?
Yes, yes. By the way, on Thursday I'll have that sheet ready. And what I think I'll do is to indicate the topics that have emerged in previous times. And one of those has to do with providence, particularly providence in relation to evil, which is a major issue that arises here. Yeah, you get the idea that God is a sort of cosmic chess player. Human beings are pawns that he moves around on the chessboard, but that's that I don't think is the case. But we'll deal with that in one of these extra sessions. Okay, I wish we had much more time to deal with that, but we don't. So I hope that gives you some insight into how you ought to try to interpret biblical materials, particularly when they are biographical. They focus on persons, although, as I say, the historical is of similar sort. You need to try to relive experiences in order to interpret them. Excellent.
Can you just repeat what you said, what we see as God
through Abraham? Yes, God as the covenant maker and covenant keeper. It begins to be a covenant keeper. And that latter motif, of course, continues in the other narratives as well, as you found by tracing the promises of the covenant as they recur in these other narratives. Okay? Now, let's turn our attention to Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, which we have kept until last in order best to illustrate what we mean by seeing parts of a book in light of the book as a whole. When we come to this passage, we often come to it with a certain baggage, with our own preconceptions, preoccupations, etc. And as a result, we often look at it in the wrong way. That is to say, from our perspective instead of from the perspective of the author. Now, what we have found in this book as a whole is that the book is primarily theological. Concern is with a theological problem, problem of sin and judgment, and with a theological solution, the kind of God who resolves that problem through a covenant made with his people. In other words, the focus is theological. It should not surprise us, therefore, that the focus of 1:1 to 2:3 is also theological. It is not, by the way, scientific, which is often our preoccupation. And by the way, because of our preoccupation, we often miss the central thrust and purpose of the chapter, which is theological. See, the scientific question is the how question. Question of process. How did the world come to be, or the universe come to be? That's the scientific question. Big Bang theory. This small piece of matter that included tremendous energy and that exploded and created the universe. That's how. One theory of the how. That's process. This is the concern of science. The concern of Genesis 1:1 to 2:3 is not the how. There's almost nothing about the how. The brevity of the material would suggest that. Well, the first day, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. I mean, there's no interest in the how light came to be. No, it told nothing about it. The major concern is with the who. Not with the process, but with the originator. God who creates. That's the major concern. Because, as we discovered, you cannot have a Redeemer unless he is also the Creator. Because, and let me refresh your mind on what we said, it takes a Creator, one, to have the desire to redeem. Why should he want to redeem this unless it belongs to him, unless he created it for a purpose? If someone else says, forget about it, would be the inclination. And secondly, he has the capacity to redeem. By the way, as you saw in Exodus, redemption requires miracles. Redemption requires the control of the non-human world. That's the plagues, for example. See? That's what it took to deliver the people from Egypt and thereby keep the covenant. See? But the one who can do that is the one who made the universe in the first place. Or indeed, to put it more broadly, the only one who can repair the universe is the one who created it. Or, to put it another way, the only one who can recreate the universe is the one who created it in the first place. And if you want to take a broad biblical motif, recreation, redemption is recreation. You and I are new persons. There's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. Revelation. Why? Because the God who created in the first place is at work to redeem. So this is the great concern. The who? Creator. Now, that's borne up by the literary features of the passage. In that connection, let me enunciate the principles which we'll be using here and out of which you get this. I'm anticipating now what we'll find. First of all, a passage or a book should be interpreted and evaluated primarily in the light of its major purpose and message. So we ought to go at this passage, Genesis 1:1 and 2:3, on the basis of answering the question, what is the major thrust of this author, both by way of interpreting it, and then asking ourselves, how well does the author do by way of accomplishing his purpose? Now, if we ask how well does he do with regard to the how, we're asking the wrong kind of question. We're not asking the question the author is concerned about. And Well, it's like asking the question about a book of recipes, cooking recipes. How well does this author describe the atom bomb?
Terrible. I've heard book reviews which criticize books on the basis not of what the author is trying to do, but on some other basis. And the poor author sits there, I've seen these interviews on TV, almost stunned. I wasn't trying to do that. What are you talking about?
So we have to focus on the major thrust of the author, both by way of interpretation and evaluation. And, as I've just indicated, the primary purpose and message of a passage or book is seen through its literary form. In other words, you have to look at the literature itself, including its structure, and ask yourself, what do we see through the literary form of this as to what the author's major purpose is, by which we can then interpret the passage and evaluate it. Now, with that in mind, let's look at the literary form of the passage very, very quickly. In terms of overall structure, you have a certain symmetry in the structure, which I think is significant. There are three major laws at work here. The third one is not evident on this overhead, but it's here nonetheless. You have the law of introduction involving particularization with preparation in 1-1 to 2. 1-1 could be interpreted in one of three ways. Either as an original creation which was somehow destroyed. Are you hearing me now? Don't be so concerned about copying this if you don't hear me. There are three ways of interpreting 1-1. An original creation which was then destroyed and recreated, so that between 1 verses 1 and 2 you have a destruction of a creation that's described in 1-1, and then in 1-2 you have the chaos that results from the destruction, and then in 1-3 following you have a recreation. That's one way in which it's been interpreted. We don't have the time to look at the evidence pro and con. I would say that has the weakest evidence in its favor. A second way of interpreting 1-1 is to understand 1-1 as the creation of matter, which is then described in 1-2 in its chaotic form. In other words, in the beginning God made the matter out of which the heavens and the earth were created. This matter was without form and void, and then he took this matter and created it. So it's the making of matter. Now that has stronger evidence in its favor, but in my view, and I wish we had more time to look at it, does not have the strongest evidence in its favor. The one that has the strongest evidence in its favor, as I see it, is to view 1-1 as a superscription or title over the whole. The beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now this is specifically what he did to create. In that case, the passage does not deal with the origin of matter. It doesn't mean that the passage is implying that matter existed eternally with God. It simply doesn't deal with it. Now, the main reason why I say that that point of view has the most evidence in its favor has to do with the meaning of create. To create is not to make matter. We often think of creation as making something. To create, bara, literally means to form, to shape, to carve, to sculpt. So I like to think of God as a sort of cosmic Michelangelo. Yeah. Told that the stone with which God began, like the great sculptor Michelangelo, is this formless and void matter, this watery matter, in 2, and then in 3, God, like Michelangelo, starts sculpting it step by step. I love reading the agony and the ecstasy.
on Michelangelo, indicating how he went about doing his sculpting. So that's particularization. See, the superscription is the general statement. And then you're prepared by being given the chaos here, out of which God then forms or carves or shapes the universe. Now, there's a very interesting symmetry in terms of two pairs of threes. Because apparently what you have in the first 3 days is the setting of the stage, in relation to which something is done in each of the subsequent days. You have the creation of light in very general terms here, and then the creation on day four, that's just day one, day four, of specific light bearers, namely the sun, the moon, and the stars. That's literally what the Hebrew means, light bearers, light carriers. Then you have the creation of the firmament, this vast expanse there, and the separation of the waters above from the waters beneath. The waters above probably referred to clouds there, provided rain, and the waters beneath the seas. And then with regard to the firmament, on day five, you have the creation of birds who fly around the firmament, and then with regard to the waters, the living creatures that inhabit the waters. And then on day three, the dry land emerges, and vegetation is created. And then on day six, creatures are made for the dry land, including man. By the way, I'm using that generically now. Man and woman are the climax of creation. That's the third law. In addition to this particularization, preparation and realization, climax. And then the vegetation is given to these creatures for food. So you see, what happens is that the preparation is made, the stage is set, and then those things are created which inhabit the stage. And then, of course, you have the conclusion, the Shabbat of God, the rest of God, that formed the basis for the law that you saw in the Decalogue. You shall not work on the Sabbath because God rested on the seventh day. So, by the way, as we shall see there, the seventh day is a reminder that God is the Creator. And we hallow God, we set God apart, when we remind ourselves that He is a Creator, and therefore transcendent, set apart from all other beings as Creator. Now, and what it reminds us of, the rest of God, is that creation itself is finished. That's why He rested, you see. Now, we need to distinguish between original creation and what Brunner calls ongoing creation, because in a way, we know that God did not cease being active after creation. Had He ceased being active, that would have been the end of the story, particularly once you had the introduction of human sin. God continues to act, and He continues in a sense to create, in a sense. But in terms of the original creation, that's done and finished. That's what's suggested by the seventh day of rest. Then you also have symmetrical structure, not only in terms of these creative day periods, which we saw were structured in a certain way, particularly in terms of preparation and realization, but also within those creative day periods, you have the recurring use of the creative formula. And all of this lends itself, by the way, to easy memorization. You can almost recite what happened, can't you? And the people probably did recite what happened. Much of this is structured as tradition, which can be passed down orally. Now, what is the creative formula? This is it approximately. There are some variations in it, but these are the main components of it. And here again, look at your text and see how this happens. You have, of course, a creative act. God said, God made, etc. There are various verbs used. The creative act. By, of course, God. Then the creative event, and it was so. And of course, there's causation between those two. And you'd fall out of your chair, wouldn't you, if the text read,
And God said, let there be light, and there was not light. You fall out of your chair, wouldn't you? You know, we tend to take these things for granted. Not one word that God speaks is not kept. It does not happen. Everything he says happens. No opposition, by the way. And then the creative judgment, and God saw that it was good, tov, pleasing to him, a fulfillment of his purposes. And then the creative nomenclature, and God called, gave names to these things. All the light day. And then the creative period. And there was evening and there was morning. First, seventh, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. Now, let me just add this element of recurrence here. The recurring use of God in relation to the various verbs of creation, the acts of God. In other words, the focus is on the acts of the God who creates. So the emphasis is dramatic in regard to action. Very little discourse. Of discourse is this self-dialogue which you have in relation to creation, human beings, let us make a man, woman in our image. Okay, now let me look at some other features with you here. The language and the style, you have very simple language. In fact, you can read this to children and they'll understand. It's interesting. Complex thing is the creation of the universe can be understood by little children. That's the nature of this language. It doesn't take a cosmic scientist to understand this. Pictorial language, it's been dramatized. You can dramatize it pictorially. You have God, big beard, you know. Thing. Stage is dark. Let there be light. All of a sudden, light goes on the stage, you know. You can write a play from this, as it's been done. And it has flexible language. Now, this is where we get caught up. This is all the great controversy that we have nowadays, you know. What does this story say with regard to creation and how long creation took? This word yom, day, is used in three ways in the passage. It is used, of course, in 3 day periods prior to the creation of the sun. So it could not, in those cases, refer to solar day. You can't have a solar day until the 4th day of creation. Day means light. That's what the light is called, day. But of course, it is used after the creation of the sun, and so could include at least the solar day, although it may not refer exclusively to the solar day. And then in 2:4, it is used to describe the whole creative period. In the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. That's the whole thing. Day, yom, is used very flexibly here. And to understand this as meaning, in all cases, a 24-hour period, a solar day, I think is to misunderstand the meaning of yom as it's used in this context. One of the great problems we have is to be sure, as sure as we can be, of what this really means, and this passage really means. And here is one of the critical issues as far as interpretation is concerned. These people, you know, who come out with these dogmatic statements. The Bible teaches that the earth was created in 6 consecutive 24-hour periods. I think they're overlooking a lot of evidence that needs to be examined pretty carefully. It indicates at least another or other possibilities. That is that yom refers to periods. of creation and not a 24-hour day. To say nothing of the consecutive element here, in terms of six consecutive 24-hour periods. And finally, we've mentioned this already, terseness and brevity, which suggests that it's not concerned primarily with the how, very little as far as the how is concerned. The main purpose and message then, in light of this kind of literature, is theological. It emphasizes the God who creates. Very little emphasis on the how. In fact, you suspect that it was structured in such a way so as to contribute to memory. No. I'm not saying that's the only thing involved, but you suspect that that was a major element in terms of passing on a tradition, which had to do, which was done primarily by memory, orally, and not written. Yes.
But the reference to comment on day, how does that relate to the
That's a good question, and I think there are various possibilities there. The obvious meaning would be clear would have to do with a 24-hour period, but what that may suggest simply is the beginning and end of a period. That's the other possible interpretation, if it's more than a 24-hour period, it's a creative period. Now, our time is almost up here, and there's much more that we could do here. Let me just indicate very quickly the two main ways of understanding the theology of this narrative, which is its main purpose and therefore the basis on which we ought to examine it, has to do with the names used for God and then, of course, the verbs used for God, and we want to emphasize the latter. Elohim probably comes from a root which means the mighty one, which, of course, is fitting and appropriate for the Creator. That's one of the things that comes through most strongly, is the great power of this one who creates. In fact, we could focus on the verb create, and if we did, especially in view of the fact that God creates by his word, which, by the way, is the easiest thing to use, except nothing. Don't you wish you could say about your work, "Let my work be done"? Let my study of Exodus 1:1 to 6:9 be done. All of a sudden, it's done. It's pretty easy, isn't it? So the moment you have God creating by his word, you really have tremendous power at work. Irresistible power. He says it, and it's done. Nothing challenges his word. Nothing can challenge his word. How to create without really trying? You have a notion that the power to create is only an infinitesimal amount of the power that God has. And if you really wanted to work at it, oh my, what he did. He just, God said, there it is. So, the unimaginable power of God, which may well be captured by Elohim. Elohim, by the way, is in the Hebrew plural. Im is the plural ending. Very interesting phenomenon is that you have a plural subject with almost in every case, except for the creation of man and woman, you have a singular verb.
So the great emphasis in the passage is on monotheism. One God who created all things has all the power and deserves all the glory that is involved in his divine activities. Plural is the plural of majesty and honor. There is no need to worship many gods, for in the one God resides all that is necessary to be God. The God who creates, and eventually the God who redeems. And what we have seen in this passage, then, is the great emphasis on God as personal creator.
And the purpose of the passage then is to inspire awe and worship. Its purpose is not to describe in detail the process of creation. Rather, it is to cause the reader to bow down in the presence of this great God, the creator of all things, and to worship him as the one who has made us with a purpose which he intends for us to fulfill. So let us look then at this chapter in light of this great theological purpose, this great worship-inspiring purpose. And let us, as we read it, never forget this purpose and bow down in the presence of our Creator, who is over all things because he has made all things. Amen. Look at structure involving two elements. What are the two things you look for when you look for the structure of the book as a whole, or any part as a whole? You're talking now about primary laws, John, one of the criteria. But I'm thinking in terms of the two facets of looking for structure. What are the two things you look for? All right, first of all, the major units. Subunits, if possible, but I would focus on the most major units, which we call what? Divisions. So I would look for the major units of a book as a whole, or a part as a whole. Now, there wouldn't be divisions in a part as a whole, but the major units, subunits, if possible. That's the first thing. The second thing you look for, then, is what, John? What you were referring to. And you look for that in relation to what? So what you're looking for is not the amount of materials, but what? What's the focus?
Obviously,
the primary laws you're looking for.
Oh, I thought
that was right. No, the primary laws that relate these units to each other into the book as a whole, and the specific materials with which they're used, and one of the major criteria for determining which laws are primary has to do with the amount of material controlled by the law. So those are the two elements involved in surveying books or parts of books as wholes. Are we clear on that now? Okay, let's now look at Exodus, keeping those two elements in mind, and we'll intertwine them. Because in both cases, you're looking for what? What's the common element in both cases? Which is one of a number of structural laws. So you're really looking for structural laws. That's the common element involving both of these operations. Because it's laws that bind materials together into units, and the laws that relate them to each other in terms of the book as a whole. So what you're really looking for are laws within the units and then between the units, within materials to form units and between the units to form the book as a whole. Well, let me get us started here with regard to the book, and then we'll get some input from you and try to have some dialogue on our findings. Let me first mention that the name Exodus, which comes from the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, the Septuagint is a 2nd century B.C. Greek translation, comes from the two Greek words ekhodos, which literally means the way out, which is a very appropriate name, as covered for the book as a whole. And indeed, that points up one of the main elements that recurs in the book as a whole, and that is to say, the recurrence of the deliverance motif
to take the time and the space, you would give verse references where this motif is found. And by the way, it's found both in terms of repetition, some of the same words are used over and over again, such as redeem, deliver, etc., but also in the form of continuity, in that you have a number of synonymous ways of expressing this relationship, such as bring forth, let go, send out, etc. So you have a number of ways of describing or of presenting and expressing this element. Now, I've included the name of the book, which is not part of the structure here, simply because it fits in with this particular recurrence of this deliverance motif. I've given you just some references, but you see that even within the chapters that I've given you, you see how frequently that motif is mentioned. By the way, it's mentioned throughout the book as a whole, even in those areas that follow the actual Exodus and subsequent deliverances. You have allusion back to the Exodus as a primary element which makes possible and undergirds everything else. So this, I would say, is one of the main laws that binds the materials together. We haven't yet found units, but this binds the materials together. Now let's ask questions here. What is meant by redemption? What's involved in it? How did redemption or deliverance occur? Why did it occur? And why the recurring emphasis on redemption in the book as a whole? And, of course, what are the implications of the answers to these questions? Obviously, the book is emphasizing the great importance of God's deliverance of his people from Egypt. And that has tremendous significance in its own right and many, many implications, we shall begin to see when we look at parts of the book as a whole. Do you have any questions on that first law? Now, while it comes to mind, let me indicate what we're doing with regard to the copies of these transparencies in the library. What I'm doing from now on is, in addition to numbering them consecutively, I'm placing the latest ones on top, so that you'll find some high numbers on top of the stack, so you don't have to rifle through the rest of them to find out which the new ones are. And when I put more in there, I'll put the ones that are on top now underneath the pile and add the ones that I put in on top, okay? And they will be in consecutive order on top, beginning with the lowest number and moving toward the highest number until you reach the first page. Is that there? Okay. Let's move now to another relationship. Any other relationships here? Let me get some feedback from you on this. What did you find as one of the most major relationships in the book as a whole? Dixie? Law of the pivot. And where is the pivot involved?
Dixie?
All right, you're alluding to 14, the Red Sea experience, or Sea of Reeds experience in chapter 14. But actually, that occurred after the basic deliverance, didn't it? The basic deliverance is where? In chapter 12. So even between those, you would need to make a choice, unless you have recurrence of pivot. All right, but then let me call attention to other deliverances. And had these not other deliverances not happened, the previous ones would have been meaningless. Namely, the deliverances having to do with water in the wilderness, and manna and quail in the wilderness, and deliverance from the Amalekites. And that unit after they crossed the Sea of Reeds there, I'm referring to 16, basically to 16 to 18.
really 16 and 17. So you have a whole series of deliverances, don't you? In a sense, even what happens in 32 and 34, toward the end of the book, where you have the golden calf episode, you have a deliverance. That's a different kind of deliverance. Deliverance from internal problems is over against external problems. So you have really a whole series of deliverances. That's one reason why this motif is dominant in so much of this material.
I guess I was looking at it for a sense that for 100 years they've been under Eastern power, and they were that great power then going into returning and the relationship.
There again, as I say, you need to make up your mind as to which is the basic deliverance. Is it 12 or 15? And I would say on the basis of what you have in 12, and on the basis of the Passover, this great memorial, now what you have in connection with 15 is this song of Moses, you know, but the great memorial is in connection with what you have in 12. I mean, that's what the people remembered. So that for that reason and many other reasons which we could cite, and by the way, when the Exodus is talked about, really what happened in 12 is what's being talked about. 15 simply finalizes that, because Pharaoh changes his mind and decides to chase the Israelites. Of course, God takes care of them there too. But the basic deliverance, where Pharaoh throws them out by his own hand, by the way, he gets so sick and tired of all these problems that they're causing that he says, look, get out of here, go, I don't want you anymore. Which God said, by the way, would happen. In the material that we'll look at beginning tomorrow. Now, in terms of the law, quite apart from where we focus it, here is a case where we need to make a decision because relationships tend to be intertwined here. One could call, for example, 12 a pivot and 15 a pivot. The thing that comes to mind, and you could call it, by the way, also contrast. The thing that comes to mind has to do with the fact that much of the material prior to 12, and that's also true of what you have in 14 and 15, really is leading up to the Exodus. In other words, you're not surprised by the Exodus, are you? In 12, 15. Everything is leading up to it. So, the question, not everything, most of the material is leading up to it. So the question is whether you really have a pivot, which involves a radical change of direction at a certain point, or whether you have another relationship involved, perhaps contrast, which would be related to the pivotal idea, but not so radical. Or another possibility is interrogation, problem followed by solution. And by the way, in relation to interrogation, you also have contrast, because obviously there's a contrast between a problem and the solution. We found a contrast, didn't we, in Genesis. Genesis 1 to 11, particularly 3 to 11, the problem, 12 following, the curse, sin and the curse, 12 following, redemption and blessing, you see. So those are the kinds of decisions that need to be made. With regard to trying to pinpoint the exact relationship. Now let me just tentatively indicate the recurrence of interrogation as a way of looking at that phenomenon, recognizing that these other elements might well be involved. I mean, that you can cite arguments pro and con here. This is the kind of process you need to go through by way of trying to decide how to identify a relationship. Because, as we pointed out, when we talked about general and specific relationships, these relationships overlap. So you need to simply look at the evidence and beat the evidence. And by the way, we'll simply put a question mark after this and hold off until we begin looking at the parts. Of course, I've got a leg up on you in that regard because I've looked at the parts already. So that's why I tend to lean in this direction on the basis of what I find in the parts. In any case, what you may well have here is a problem, the problem of bondage in Egypt, obviously, which is described in chapter 1, primarily. And then the solution actually begins where? Chapter 2.
with the birth of Moses, the preservation of Moses, etc. In fact, even at the end of chapter 1, you have statements concerning God's activity when he stifles the plan of genocide with regard to destroying the firstborn. So God begins to be active very quickly here with regard to the problem, which is described in chapter 1. And of course in 3 you have Moses called, the burning bush experience, and Moses called to be the deliverer. And then, of course, you have a whole process of events, especially the 10 plagues, which lead up to the deliverance. You see, most of the material, this material, involves a process of deliverance. In fact, we'll look at, let me put down here, and we'll describe it in terms, by the way, here we've asked questions, and we won't put questions down here, but we ask questions. You can describe this material in terms of recurrence of contrast, both in terms of geography and in terms of history, if you're looking at it in regard to surface structure, surface units, in that the material in 1:1 and 12:36 is basically in Egypt. And then, that's chapter 1, 12:36. And then 12:37 to chapter 18. On the way to Sinai. Of course, the fact that we're going to Sinai immediately, they've been delivered from Egypt. And then 19 to 40 at Sinai. Now, I've noted recurrence here just to call attention to the basis on which we determine these units. That is to say, these materials are recurringly found in Egypt, and then you have a change, and though technically speaking they're still in Egypt, they're on their way to Sinai. Incidentally, you have materials, for example, in 13, say at the end of 13, in 17 following, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, lest the people repent when they see war and return to Egypt. In other words, he's afraid that they'll change their minds, and by the way, they keep talking about changing their minds, and ruining the fact that they've been delivered from Egypt. So he wants to get them far away, so far away that they can't come back. But God led the people round by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea, a longer way, etc. And by the way, in that paragraph you have the bones of Joseph mentioned. Did you catch those? In 19, and Moses took the bones of Joseph with him this long way around. For Joseph had solemnly sworn the people of Israel, saying, God will visit you, then you must carry my bones with you from here. And then you have subsequent movements involving these various locales. So actually, they're on their way to Sinai here, although there is this Sea of Reeds episode which we'll look at eventually here in terms of geography. So you have this element, and then you have in this, see if you can raise this line, historically you have a series of deliverances. And we've mentioned two major ones, the one from Egypt here, and the one at the Sea of Reeds here, but also deliverance from thirst and hunger and the Amalekites. Jane and I took a trip to the traditional site of Sinai, and I tell you, all you need to do is to be down there and look around to get a sense of absolute amazement as to how these people, 600,000 men, plus women and children, you're talking about a mob of people, could ever have survived. It is absolutely barren, absolutely barren. When it comes to getting food and water, forget it. There's really no way, except for the Bedouins, who scrounge around with a few animals, and they're few and far between. You don't have this tremendous group of people.
few and far between who are able to find a little greenery here and there, particularly when it rains once in a while, in order to support their sheep and therefore have a livelihood. So you had deliverances here too. They could have died here. Of course, had they died here, all of what preceded would have been meaningless. In fact, they keep saying, you know, we're going to die in the wilderness here. What's the whole point? We had food at least in Egypt. Why in the world take us into the wilderness and say to us, you're delivering us if we're going to die here? So you have a whole series of deliverances here through 18, and then here you have the great emphasis on legislation, on law, and construction of the tabernacle. Those are the two major elements in these materials, which occur at Sinai. So the pre-Sinai materials focus on deliverances, historically, events, and they once they arrive at Sinai, it's legislation, law, in 19 to 24, really, and then the construction of the tabernacle in 25 to 40, and in the midst of that, you have this golden calf episode in 32 to 34 that we mentioned before, which involves another kind of problem. But they brought on themselves, drove against these problems that preceded, which were brought on them by external forces. Okay, now, so what you have here then is the problem of bondage in Egypt and the plot of the Pharaoh, which we'll look at in greater detail beginning tomorrow, and the solution to that problem involving the birth of Moses, the preservation of Moses, the training of Moses in Midian, and then of course the calling of Moses and the plagues, all leading up to this thing. And then of course another problem develops. That is, the Pharaoh changes his mind and decides to chase after them. And of course that's resolved by what happens in 14. And then these other problems develop. People start murmuring because of lack of water, lack of food. And those problems are resolved. And then you have the subsequent problems that you have here that we come to later on, where this one is obvious. No sooner is the law given than it's violated. People are on the verge of being destroyed. It was given to the people. It was given to the people in 24. The book of the covenant was ratified. Now, they were aware that this was part of the law which they were violating. They violate the law and are about to be destroyed, and Moses intercedes on their behalf, and are saved from here. And there are other problems as well. This is the basic problem that's involved here, and we have the resolution of that problem. So it could be viewed in that way, although, as I say, these other things could be involved in a sense.
I saw another problem besides this deliverance, and that's sort of related to the instrumentation. We see the problem of God wanting to identify himself and make them really aware of who he was, prove himself to them, that they would know that when they were delivered by that time, that he was their God.
All right, you've gotten at an element that is involved, a very important element that's involved in the substructure here. And by the way, let me describe that substructure here. Now, what you have previously is at least close to the surface, although what we've indicated here in interrogation, what we've just described, moves toward the subsurface kind of thing. Because what you have in this first unit is the need for deliverance, the problem, deliverance says, and the process and accomplishment of deliverance. And if you want to include these deliverances, well, you could draw this out here, as a matter of fact, and that's probably the best way of doing it. Here. And then you have the legislation and the construction, and you have to ask, how are these two related to each other? It's particularly if these are the two broadest units, how are the two related to each other? And this gets at what you were talking about, Bill, and how that's achieved. How are they related to each other?
Well, the second part sets up the relationship with the people. that he, the first part, I see him preparing the people to see how he was provident, that he was that he was with them, he was their God, and then he wanted to create them as their, his people, therefore he created a means for that, maintain that relationship through the law, through the worship, etc., that was created after the law was given, or at the time of the law.
Okay, how would you pinpoint that structurally in terms of laws of relationship?
Well, I would think preparation, well, looking from God's aspect, God's preparing the people to realize the very end of what's coming to the people.
Now, remember, preparation is a general law. And sometimes that's the only way you can identify a relationship, but if there's a more specific and precise way of doing it, you ought to do it. So the question is there a more precise and specific way of identifying that relationship? Let me give you what I think is a very significant clue, and it's found in the Decalogue itself, in chapter 20, which has a preamble to it. 20 verses 1 and 2 really summarize in a very brief form chapters 1 to 18, right? And God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God. By the way, this involves the element of revelation that you're talking about, Bill. Who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That's a way of indicating what's happened here. I've done this for you. And then what you have is the Decalogue. You shall have no other gods before me, etc. Now here again, you have a parataxis, a gap. What's the relationship that you have to supply between that preamble and the commandments? Stuart? Causation. Yeah. Therefore, because I have done this for you, it follows that you ought to do this for me. So you have a link here of causation between these two major units. By the way, obedience in both of these areas, the legislation and the construction of the tabernacle, obedience follows deliverance. It is the product of deliverance. Now, with this causation is instrumentation as well, because the effect also represents the purpose of God. And what, in other words, this is purpose, you see. And this is means for achieving the purpose. I mean, I say this, I mean everything preceding 18. And the means has to do with the fact that in these causal events, God is revealing himself to the end that, knowing who he is, they may as a result do certain things in relation to his will and his purpose. So you've picked up on a very, very significant element here. In fact, I have it here, causation with instrumentation. In other words, what you have in these materials then really is here the need for process of accomplishment of deliverances, and here the responsibilities or the outcomes. of deliverance, what the people as a result ought to do because of what God has done for them. I have done these things for you, therefore you do these things for me, and my purpose is that you do these things for me. Okay? And does this relate to what you were talking about? This what you were saying here? Now, this is very, very significant in this book as a whole, by way of tying together these various elements. Now, did you have something else to add, or is this what you had in mind, Stuart, when you raised your hand? No, okay. Now, let's ask some questions on the basis of this. What questions would you ask if you were to observe, you had observed, or if you did observe this relationship?
Causation with instrumentation.
Volunteers? Bill?
Well, what is meant by particular means that God used to deliver them, to prepare them for that purpose? Why did he use all the mighty acts? Why did they go through the particular instances in the wilderness, etc.?
All right, those questions focus on which element in the law here. Yes. I would focus on the causation first and then bring into play the instrumentation, because I think the causation is what is dominant, as I say, in the Decalogue, for example. And in fact, you have it repeated over and over again. Do this because I have done this for you. It's the result. So I would focus on what's involved in the causes, what's involved in the effect, how do the causes produce the effect, or effects, in what sense do the causes provide the means, in what sense do does the effect reflect the purpose of God, and how do the means produce or relate to the purpose. So I would tie those two things together, with a focus perhaps on the causation element. And then why this causal movement? You see the tiers of questions, beginning with the definitive questions, including the motive questions, the how questions, and then the rational question, why, and then, of course, what are the implications of the answer to these questions? We haven't asked all of them, and I could take the time here to ask more if you have questions about the questioning process. Are we clear now on this law and the kinds of questions you would ask? Okay, yes, Dixon. Pardon me? Yes, I could let me focus on the causal element here. Is this what you're asking now? I did this orally, but you wanted to see them, is that the idea? Yeah, what is involved in the causes? What's meant by the causes? By the way, you could explore the means, if you have in mind the instrumentation as well, as part of the causes. But very often you have instrumental causation, which is really the combination. These causes are also instrumental. So you could look at them together. And why are these causes stressed? What may be inferred from these matters? Note here that what I've done is to separate the two components of the law, thinking in terms of causation now, looking at cause and then effect as separate elements. Against combining them, which is another way of doing it, which is what I illustrated, and which is what you have in the examples that I've given. Then you can move to the effects. What's involved in the effects of 19 following? Why are these effects emphasized? And how do these effects result from what precedes? Actually, you could reverse the sequence of those two questions. Why should the preceding causes have these effects, and why is causation emphasized, and then what are the implications of these things? When I ask questions of this sort, I often have the two laws that are related here in mind, so when I look at causes, I look at instrumentation as well. In fact, they're bound together so much that when you see the one, you see the other, really. What you were talking about, as we shall see, Bill, in terms of revelation, involves both cause and instrument. For example, you're looking at 1:1-6:9 for tomorrow. You find instrumentation in relation to revelation there in the answer that God gives to the last question that's raised there when Moses and Aaron confront Pharaoh. And he says to them, and this involves both result and purpose implicitly, for example, in 6:7, I will take you for my people, I will be your God, and you shall know, that's the revelation, that I am the Lord your God. So that's the causation. You see, as a result of what I do, you will know. And in fact, I'm doing this in order that you may know. In fact, the plagues uses the instrumental kind of construction. annihilation of each of the plagues and their knowledge of God through the plagues.
That's where I was having the trouble with the causation, because in essence, to me it looked like there's only one cause, and really it seems God. And that's why I saw the instrumentation being a little more important, because God was the cause moving through it, but the means were what stood out to me in the first 7 or 18 chapters. That's why I didn't catch the causation element.
See, in that sense, though, you have hold of something that's not distinctive, because you could say that of every one of these books, except the Book of Esther, that doesn't mention God, by the way. Now, if you find causation in all of these books, you say the cause is God. But how are the books differentiated from each other? So it's God using or doing certain things, using certain means for certain purposes. That's what's involved in the causation here, not merely God. God doesn't say, I am God, simply I'm God, therefore you ought to do this. No, it's because I have done these things.
That's why you have to blend the two together.
Yes, yes, yes. See, the great emphasis, and we didn't have enough time to deal with it, the creation narrative, I have it on the transparencies that I put in the library. But the great emphasis here is on action. In fact, what you want to look at in these materials particularly are the verbs. What God does. Now we're looking at creation. The verbs of creation are very, very significant because, and here we get to Revelation, God is revealed through his acts. Remember, we're talking about the reversal of the causal process? And that is, it's the being of God which results in his acts. And that's involved in the history of God. God had history. Now, to understand this being, to know what God means, God itself is meaningless. To know what God means, to give content to God, you have to move back from the acts and through the acts to the being. So the focus is on the acts, which of course are captured in the verbs. So what does God do in order to, and with a result that, certain things shall happen? So that's the great emphasis. And you'll see that in the plagues, as I say, with purpose construction, right? Where he performs these ten plagues. I will do this in order that various ones may know that I am the Lord, your God. Okay, have you followed me? Now, I would say the last law here is the law of climax, and that centers around the work motif, which is a dominant motif in the book as a whole and is related to deliverance. It's actually part of this deliverance motif, the work motif. And there are three aspects to the work motif, and it's described, by the way, in various ways using such anthropomorphisms as the hand of God and the arm of God, and such terms as serving, working for. First of all, the people worked for Pharaoh. That's obvious in the opening part of the book here. That's the story of their bondage. The people worked for Pharaoh. And then we have God working, using his hands, his strong arm, on behalf of the people. I've given you a number of the references here, not all of them by any means. And of course, that's the story of deliverance. And then finally, the people worked for God, which is what you have in the instruction. And so you find the following then. Cover this so you hear what I'm saying to you. You find then the following in chapter 40, at the very end of the chapter, in 33, where you have Moses completing the tabernacle. After people had been involved in this whole project, he erected the court around the tabernacle and the altar and set up the screen of the gate of the court. So Moses finished the work. This is the completion
of the work of the leaders after the people had done their work. Then, here's the great climax. Then the cloud covered the tent of the meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. You have God revealing himself in his Shekinah glory, all of this splendor and majesty in the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because of the cloud upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled their tabernacle. Note, again, that's emphasized, very significant. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the people of Israel would go onward. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not go onward till the day it was taken up. For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel. Now, talking about purpose, this is what God wants in all this. He is doing all this in order that he may live in the midst of his people, in all his glory, and in order that in turn his people may worship him as their God and their king. By the way, they were serving Pharaoh back here. And they were delivered from that service, that bondage to Pharaoh, in order that they might serve a new king. This is the beginning of the movement toward theocracy. The new king is God, whom they now can serve and worship without the restrictions they had needed. So this is the grand climax toward which all of this is moving. And everything prior to it is part of this recurring causation and instrumentation which produces this climax. Involving these three stages. They work for Pharaoh, God works for them, they now work for God, and God responds by filling the tabernacle with his glory. Yes.
You mentioned earlier that the Exodus might not be a pivot. Would that be then another climax? A lesser climax?